Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our first look at the kidnapping and murder of Polly Klass. Before we get into this week's story, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as access to exclusive content. And as always, I've got to give a shout-out to my first two Deathcasters, Channel and Anthony. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Now, at the time that this particular case takes place, America had seen some pretty major missing children cases. This is one of the first ones, however, that got national media attention, thanks in part to the involvement of movie stars. And we're going to get into that once we really start dissecting this thing. Now, unfortunately, Polly's case is an all too common occurrence in not just this country, but in the world in general. In our current society here in America, though, it's one of those cases where people would be devastated by it, while one half would complain about the fact that this normal white girl is getting so much attention. I personally think that is abhorrent. Anyone that goes missing deserves the same amount of attention, whether they're a particular color or attractive or not, but that is the society we live in, where people get to bitch about the things that they want to, and the echo chamber of idiots that exists on many social media platforms amplify their voices. Polly Hannah Klass was born January 3rd, 1981, to Mark Klass and his wife Eve Klass in Fairfax, California. Polly's parents divorced when she was around 2 years old, and as a young child, Polly and her mother moved around fairly frequently. Because of this, it was said that Polly was fairly quiet and withdrawn and unable to make friends easily, which is completely understandable as children need that stability in their lives. Despite this upheaval, Polly's father, Mark, who owned a car rental agency in San Francisco, remained a constant in her life, and in fact, years later, would state that despite the fact that his marriage had failed, his relationship with her mother, Eve, remained strong. And Polly was fairly close to her father's side of the family, seeing her father regularly and constantly going on trips with her grandparents from her father's side. Now, her mother, Eve, ends up getting remarried. A man by the name of Alan Nicole, who had three children of his own from a previous marriage. And in 1987, another child is born into this family by the name of Annie. Of her relationship with this new family, it was said that Polly generally got along with her step-siblings, although she would on occasion clash with her stepfather, Alan, so much so that when one of the other children would misbehave, he would remark that that child was pulling a Polly. You remember I said that Polly was fairly shy? There were instances, however, where this was not the case. She was a dedicated member of the school band once the family settled in Petaluma. She was also very into acting, and it's been said that she really enjoyed getting up on stage and performing in front of other people in school plays, and in fact had ambitions of becoming an actress professionally once she was an adult. She was known to dress up as an old woman and hobble around the house carrying a cane, only to suddenly whack an individual in the butt with said cane, and doing various other things to make those around her feel comfortable and enjoy her presence. She was known to be a sweet, fun-loving, and sarcastic young girl. And as with many children, Polly was known to have a fear of the dark, so much so that even at the age of 12, she would not go to sleep at night unless there was a nightlight on in her bedroom. Her father, Mark Letter, stated that he had always told his daughter that he would be there for her if this imagined boogeyman came out of her closet and tried to get her. By the time in her life that we're talking, which is October of 1993, Polly's mother had separated from her stepfather, Alan, and they were living in a single-story blue house not far from the downtown district of Petaluma, California, with Polly's younger sister, Annie. For those unaware, Petaluma, California is a fairly well-to-do city, and at the time that Polly lived there with her mother and younger sister, the median household income was about $50,000 a year, which was extremely good in 1993. Especially for a city with only 47,000 residents. On October 1st of 1993, which was a Friday, Polly's mother agreed to allow Polly to have two friends stay over for a sleepover. These were two girls that Polly went to Palumas Junior High School together, Kate McLean and Gilliam Pelham. The three of them were best friends and were also in the band together where they all played the clarinet. Her friends would later state that that evening they took turns goofing around, posing in a Mickey Mouse hat and an antler cap before eventually getting into makeup. All very typical things for 12 and 13-year-old girls to be getting into during this point in their lives. At around 10:30 that night, after playing around and doing the things that young girls do, Polly decided that it was time for all of them to go to bed, and she went to go and get her friends' sleeping bags. Upon opening her bedroom door, Polly was confronted by a large, heavy-set, bearded man that was brandishing a knife. According to her friends, the man immediately ordered them to be quiet, stating, quote, "Don't scream or I'll cut your throats." He then asked the girls who lived there, and Polly fearlessly stated that she was the girl that lived in the house. And according to her friends, Kate and Gillian, at first they suspected this was some kind of elaborate practical joke that Polly had staged, being as Halloween was only about 4 weeks away. But as the man began to talk, the two of them quickly realized that this was in fact no prank and that the man was serious. He informed the girls that he was simply there to take money from the house and that if they listened to the things that he instructed them to do, no one would get hurt. Polly offered him a box that she had with $50 in cash, and this man refused it, ordering all three girls to lie down on the floor before tying their hands behind their backs and using pillowcases as hoods, which he placed over the girls' faces, all while assuring them that he's only doing it for the money and that he's not going to hurt any of them. Her friends later stated that Polly pleaded with the man not to hurt her mother and her sister. At this point, the man told the girls to count to 1,000 before they did anything, and picks Polly up and walks out of the room. The two girls left behind did not follow his instructions and instead struggled against the bindings that had been placed on them, eventually freeing themselves at roughly 10:45 p.m., so only about 15 minutes or so after the man appeared at Polly's bedroom door. They go racing through the house to Eve's bedroom and informed her what had happened, at which point Polly's mother places a phone call to 911. Officers arrive on the scene fairly quickly and begin processing the crime scene as well as taking information from the only two witnesses that they have inside of the home. The girls describe a large, heavy-set white male with a beard, salt and pepper hair. There really isn't a whole lot of evidence left at the scene. They find the clothing that had been used to bind and blind the girls, as well as cut cords from a Nintendo game system, which had also been used to help subdue the girls. Outside of that, the house did not appear to have been ransacked in any way. The mother's purse is found on the kitchen table, and no sign of forced entry is visible. So they begin canvassing the neighborhood while issuing an all-points bulletin to the local surrounding areas, looking for this individual, as well as giving a description of Polly Klass. And what they quickly learn is that many individuals in the neighborhood had seen this large, heavy-set, bearded man outside of the Klass home for some period of time. They didn't think anything was amiss with the man. He could have been anything from a vagrant to a local they didn't know who was just simply out for a night stroll. Very quickly, though, the police make a few missteps, the biggest of which is the fact that while they broadcast this all-points bulletin throughout the area, it did not go to every single jurisdiction. And unfortunately, the fact of this has played with the minds of both investigators and Polly's family in the decades since her disappearance, as we now know that law enforcement did in fact have contact with the individual responsible for this crime after he had taken Polly from her mother's home. However, October 1st, 1993, the police know none of this information. And we're going to get into that a little bit later. Back in Petaluma, people are frantically searching for Polyclas. A local print shop owner the next day begins organizing searches as well as prints off thousands of flyers with pictures of Polly on it asking for help in locating her. In this case instantly gets nationwide attention with the television show America's Most Wanted, hosted by John Walsh, whose son Adam was kidnapped and murdered in the early 1980s, giving a rundown on the crime as well as showing the sketch that police had drawn up from Polly's friend's recollections. As you can see, this case is very quickly building momentum. People are frantically looking for this girl who was abducted in the middle of the night from her home while two friends lay nearby subdued by the attacker. And no one has any idea who is responsible or why the man took her. Now, it's known that the police were able to get a palm print from the bedroom that would later be linked to the man responsible for this crime, although at the time, the police decided that this palm print and its existence were going to be holdback evidence. That's evidence that they don't release to the public or to the media as they continue to search and build their case. The police look at both of Polly's parents, along with her stepfather, and all three of them are quickly eliminated as suspects in this case. Police are out with dogs looking for Polly. The media is inundated with phone calls and tips, which they are sending on to the proper authorities. Really, we have a community that is in action, is terrified of what had happened, and is really just wanting this young girl who had done no harm to anyone to be returned to them. And it's at this point that Hollywood gets involved, specifically the actress Winona Ryder, who had grown up in Petaluma. She ends up putting up a $200,000 reward for information leading to the recovery alive or deceased of Polyclas. As Ryder stated, quote, "She felt a connection to Polly because this happened in the community I was raised in, and I'm lucky to be in a position to get things out there and financially offer what I can. I obviously want Polly back safe." Obviously, Polly's family is beyond distraught. The whole community in Petaluma is devastated. People in town are wearing purple ribbons because that was Polly's favorite color. They continue with their search efforts. Obviously, you know, after the first few days, some people lose hope that they're going to find Polyclas alive. And this is compounded as the days turn into weeks, and then the weeks turn into months. There is no sign of Polyclas anywhere. And despite this, officers again make a major misstep. On October 19th, 1993, a man by the name of Richard Allen Davis is pulled over and arrested for drunk driving. No one involved in the arrest or in the subsequent holding of Davis, which was estimated to be around 5 hours, noticed the fact that he resembled the sketch that had been drawn up of the man who had kidnapped Polyclas. Back in Petaluma, tips and financial aid continue to pour in. And eventually, Polly's father, Mark, creates something known as the Polly Class Foundation, whose mission at this point was simply to find his daughter safely. And her father ends up turning around and placing the print shop owner, who had organized the searches as well as made up all of the flyers concerning Polly's disappearance, a man by the name of Bill Rhodes, as the president of this foundation. This was not to last, however, as a woman came forward and stated that Rhodes had sexually molested her when she was a child. She eventually files a civil suit against Rhodes. He is forced to resign from his position within the organization. And the police would later state that whether or not this woman's claims were in fact true, Bill Rhodes was a registered sex offender, as he had been convicted of masturbating himself in front of children in 1967 and was arrested again the following year, 1968, after threatening a group of young girls with a knife and forcing them to undress for him. At which point he blindfolded the girls and physically assaulted them. And people began looking at this man, Bill Rhodes, as a potential suspect in Polly's case, given the acts that he had committed decades earlier, but also because of the similarities of the particulars in his cases, namely the brandishing of the knife and the tying up of the girls. Officers eventually clear Rhodes of any involvement in the crimes, although the community at large does not accept this at face value. Rhodes is known to have stated at some point that the reason he got involved in the search for Polly Kloss in the first place is because he was trying to make amends for his past crimes. Whether that is true or not, really, that's semantics at this point. The man is an awful human being for having done what he did to those children, but we do have to take into account that, to the best of my knowledge from diligent research, he was never accused or convicted of having perpetrated any further crimes on children, and in fact had children of his own and was, from all appearances, happily married when he passed away in 2012. A benefit concert was held for the Polly Kloss Foundation at the end of October 1993, with many luminaries coming out, including Robin Williams, who conducted an auction which, combined with ticket sales, raised over $12,000 to aid in the search for Polly Kloss. However, police are no closer to finding a suspect, despite the fact that they have a full palm print on this man and are able to identify the individual that it belongs to. However, really for reasons unknown, although I suspect it has to do with the fact that they have no physical evidence beyond this fingerprint that they're aware of yet, officers don't go after Davis. On November 28th in Santa Rosa, which is 20-25 miles north of Petaluma, a woman by the name of Dana Jaffe was walking around her property on Pythian Road. Jaffe lived on this property at the time with her 12-year-old daughter. It was a fairly secluded, heavily wooded area. She had just had loggers out, and they removed some of the trees on the property. She is out walking the property with two of her friends when they come across some items that greatly disturb them. The items included a dark sweatshirt, red tights that were knotted up, a condom wrapper with a condom that had been used lying nearby, binding tape, and a piece of cloth that would later appear to have been used as a hood. Knowing the story of Polyclass, Jaffe immediately felt her stomach sink, and turning to her companions, asked them if they believed that this might in fact be related to Polly. They rush back to Jaffe's home, where she contacts the police, reminding them that on the night of October 1st, early morning hours of October 2nd, she had had a trespasser on her property and that the police had been called. We're going to go back and look at the night of October 1st, October 2nd at the Jaffe property. On that night, a 19-year-old woman by the name of Shannon Lynch had been babysitting Jaffe's daughter. After Jaffe got home, Lynch gets in her car and begins to drive down Jaffe's driveway, which is set onto a hill. As she's going down this road, she sees what she later described as a man wearing dark clothing, examining a white Pinto which appears to have been stuck on the side of the road. Now, according to Lynn, she slowed as she neared the man and asked what the problem was. He approached her vehicle and tried to stick his hand through the window in her car, yelling at her that he's stuck and he needs some rope. Lynch ends up driving away from the man and stopping at a payphone, from which she calls Jaffe and informs her that this guy's on her property. And Jaffe would later state that hearing this news, she felt vulnerable in the house, so gathering up her daughter, she decides to leave the property and actually sees the man as she's driving down the road, armed with a baseball bat and a can of mace. She later stated that as she drove past the Pinto, she saw no sign of an individual on her property other than the car. Ends up getting to a gas station and calling the police at this point. The police, in turn, dispatched two deputies, Michael Rankin and Thomas Howard. The deputies arrive at Jaffe's home and find this Pinto stuck in the mud. And nearby, they find a large, heavy-set bearded man who they described as disheveled-looking, with dirt on his clothing and bits of leaves and broken branches in his beard. They said the man did not appear nervous, although he was sweating profusely and was continuously wiping at beads of sweat on his forehead, despite the fact that the night was fairly pleasant and not at all hot. They questioned the man, who told them his name was Richard Allen Davis. He said that he was out sightseeing and had simply gotten his car stuck. The officers obviously don't believe what he is telling them, and they run Davis's driver's license as well as the license plate on his car. Both come back clean. However, had they run a background check, they may in fact have questioned Davis a little harder. Davis was an absolutely worthless piece of shit of a human being. He was born June 2nd, 1954, in San Francisco, California. He was the third of five children, born with two older brothers and two younger sisters, one of whom is deceased. Davis had a troubled upbringing. Both of his parents were described as violent alcoholics, with one instance being given involving his mother, who burned he and his older brother's hands on the stove after she caught the boys smoking, and another instance where his mother held his hand to the hot stove after catching Richard playing with matches. His father was described as no better and has been said to have been, quote, unloving and abusive. There were many bouts of domestic violence inside of the Davis household, leading up to Davis's parents separating when he was 9 years old. Davis's mother goes back to her parents' house, and when the mother and father eventually divorce when he's 11, Davis and his siblings are given the choice, either go with your father or stay with your mother. Davis and his sisters decide to go and live with their father, while the brothers go and stay with Davis's mother, although eventually his older brother Donald would come and join them. Davis's father was a longshoreman and was frequently not at home, and as a consequence of this, his children were often neglected and shuffled between various family members. But according to his siblings, they were also taken care of by the various women his father would end up dating during their adolescent years. His children later stated that the elder Davis was extremely mentally unstable and would oftentimes go outside and fire a gun at hallucinations that he was seeing, which did not in fact exist. This very well could be directly related to his alcoholism, as it's being medically chronicled that individuals in late-stage alcoholism frequently suffer from hallucinations, be they audio or visual. Father Robert appears to have had particular animosity towards his third-born son, at one point breaking his jaw while beating him, and at another point shoving him through a wall inside of the house. Things got no better for Davis as he moved into his teenage years. At the age of 12, he ends up being arrested for the first time on charges of burglary and forgery, ends up being put on probation. When he is 14 years old, his 10-year-old sister, Patricia, ends up dying from an illness. This does nothing to quash Davis's budding criminal career. I'm going to give you, at this point, a brief chronology of Davis's life over the next few years. When he's 15 years old, he ends up dropping out of high school. On November 15th, 1969, he is arrested for breaking into a La Honda home. The following day, the 16th, Davis's father places both Richard and Donald Davis in the custody of authorities, citing incorrigibility. Now, this is the first of at least three times that Davis's father does this. It is known that somewhere during this period of time, Davis begins drinking and using drugs, which, much like his burglaries, he would later tell a psychiatrist helped him alleviate the various tensions that he felt, but also allow him to escape the mundaneness of his everyday existence. On September 15th of 1970, Davis is arrested again, this time on charges of Grand Theft Auto. He and other individuals unnamed were trying to steal a motorcycle when they were surprised by police officers. Davis's father goes to bat for his son and says that it would be in everybody's best interest, particularly Davis's, if he is forced to join the military. So the judge gives Davis the option of going into juvenile hall or enlisting in the United States military. Davis chooses the military, and he officially enlists and is sent to boot camp in July of 1971. And his military record is peppered with more acts of disobedience and defiance, with several instances of being absent without leave, otherwise known as being AWOL, infractions for fighting, failure to report for duty, as well as noted morphine usage. Davis ends up serving a little over 13 months in the United States Army, and in August of 1972, he is given what's called a general discharge, which basically means he was a shitty soldier. They did not have enough to give him a dishonorable or a bad conduct discharge, but they weren't going to give him an honorable discharge, and they simply wanted to get rid of him. 1973 finds Davis back in the Bay Area. On February 12th, he's arrested in Redwood City for public drunkenness and resisting arrest, and he's placed on 1 year of summary probation. On April 21st, he is arrested for being a minor in the possession of liquor, burglary, and contributing to the delinquency of a minor, although the trespassing charge is later dismissed. On August 13th, 1974, he is again arrested in Redwood City. Officers find him leaning drunkenly on shrubbery, and he's released once sober. On October 12th, 1973, Richard Allen Davis goes to a party at the home of an 18-year-old by the name of Marlene Voris. Later, Davis would tell authorities that Voris was his girlfriend at the time, although there really is no evidence to indicate that this was in fact the case. What we do know is this: at some point during the night, either Voris or another individual shot Voris in the head using a shotgun, killing her. When police arrived, suicide notes were found strewn throughout the house, and officers listed Voris's death as a suicide. Later, during a psychological evaluation while incarcerated, Davis would tell the psychiatrist that he had witnessed his girlfriend kill herself in front of him, and that this had haunted him, that he continuously heard her voice, and that she told him to do things. Now, this could be simply a line of bullshit from Davis. It could also be a manifestation of some form of mental illness, either hereditary such as schizophrenia, which many suspect his father as having suffered from, or brought on by his continued use of alcohol. We do know that he told at least one other psychiatrist about this in 1977, stating that it deeply affected him, and he continuously heard Voris's voice. And during this particular interview, Davis also informed the psychiatrist that he heard another unnamed woman's voice urging him to find her, rob her, rape her, and then kill her. As for Voris, many suspect that Davis was responsible for her murder. In an article written in the LA Times, a relative of one of Voris's classmates stated, quote, "There's no way that was a suicide. Marlene had just received a commission in the Navy that she had applied for. She had a party that night to celebrate and say goodbye to her friends." And some suspect that Davis may have felt spurned by the fact that Voris was leaving and decided that he would not allow her to leave him and thus killed her. Although, unfortunately, there is no direct evidence to prove whether or not Davis did in fact commit this murder. On October 24th, 1973, Richard Allen Davis is arrested for outstanding traffic citations, and it's while he's in police custody that he admits to having committed a string of burglaries from April to October, confessing to an estimated 20 burglaries. A probation officer would later write that residents were so disgusted and hateful of Davis that it may in fact be detrimental to his health and well-being were he to return to La Honda. Davis ends up getting 6 months jail time in the local jail, along with 3 years of probation. After getting out, Davis continues with his life of crime, being arrested again on May 13th of 1974 as he's in the process of robbing a South San Francisco high school. Davis is sent to Vacaville, which is the home of the California Medical Facility, which is where they send criminals that have some form of underlying mental problems. Davis is actually diagnosed with schizophrenia as well as a number of other mental disorders, and he's able to avoid jail time for the time being by enrolling in a VA alcohol treatment program, although Davis attends for one day and then simply quits, which leads him to being sentenced to a year in county jail on September 16th of 1974. He's in jail. Davis, who is said to have part Native American ancestry, learns that there is a Native American drug rehabilitation program going on and is able to convince the courts to allow him to attend this. So, after securing funding from two fellow inmates to purchase them drugs while he's on the outside, Davis is sent to this drug rehab program and then simply fails to return. At which point, Davis lives his life on the lam, which in reality just means he goes back to doing the same shit he was doing before, and the police really aren't looking for him. That is until March 2nd of 1975, when the two inmates that Davis had ripped off find him and shoot him in the back. This leads to Davis being put into the hospital and rearrested on charges of jumping his sentence. Because Davis decides to testify against the men who had assaulted him, he ends up being placed into protective custody. While he is incarcerated, Davis is released later on in the year and is again arrested on April 11th, 1975 on a parole violation. In July, he is arrested for auto theft and possession of a controlled substance, in this case marijuana, and receives a 10-year prison sentence. In connection to all of the other things that have happened, while he's in jail, Davis is sentenced to a further 6 to 15 years in relation to the crimes that he has committed in San Francisco, although he's released on August 2nd, 1976. On September 24th, 1976, Davis escalates his crimes. A 26-year-old legal secretary who worked at the South Hayward BART station in San Francisco is abducted at knife point. The woman, Frances Mays, Davis was inebriated and attempted to sexually assault her. She is able to escape his car and flags down a passing vehicle. which just so happens to have a patrol officer by the name of Jim Wentz inside of it. Wentz subsequently arrests Davis at the scene of the crime. Davis ends up trying to commit suicide in his jail cell and is sent to the Napa State Hospital for a lengthy psychological evaluation, where Davis is mistakenly registered as a voluntary patient. Davis was placed there on December 8th. On December 16th, 1976, Davis simply walks out of the hospital and embarks on a crime spree, where for his first crime, Davis breaks into the home of one of the nurses that worked at the hospital, beating her as she slept about the head with a fire poker before breaking into a nearby animal shelter where Davis steals a shotgun. He then kidnaps a bartender as she is leaving work. The woman was getting into her car when Davis approached her with the shotgun and forced her inside. Once inside the vehicle, the woman noticed that Davis had bindings on his hand and quickly realized that this is the guy who escaped from the hospital. Thinking quickly, she dives out the other side of the car, grabbing a gun that is placed between the seats as she goes, and then opens fire on Davis, who proceeds to flee on foot. As you can see, his crimes are progressively getting more aggressive, but also getting more violent. And it's worth noting at this point that there is really no idea as to what crimes Davis may have committed that we are unaware of. What I mean by that is, we have at least one assault of a woman in her bedroom, a possible murder. There are countless other crimes that he may be responsible for that have either never been linked to him, or have privately been linked to him but never been made public, or the police are simply unaware of. On December 21st, 1976, Davis breaks into the home of Josephine Krieger, who's a bank employee at a bank in La Honda. Now, details are sketchy about this particular crime. It's known that after he leaves this woman's home, someone sees Davis walking around carrying this shotgun and notifies the police, who arrive to find Davis curled into a fetal position cradling the shotgun. He is taken into custody and ends up receiving a sentence of 1 year to 25 years in prison. 2 years to life for two assaults that had occurred in Napa, and 6 months to 10 years for receiving stolen property. Davis ends up getting paroled on March 4th, 1982. After getting out of prison, Davis ends up in a relationship with a woman by the name of Sue Edwards, who was described as a blonde, 20-something, heavy-set woman who was a self-professed motorcycle mama who earned a living as a drug dealer. And it's known that this couple traversed between California, Washington, and Oregon in a never-ending crime spree of drug deals, robberies, and assaults. On November 30th, 1984, Edwards and Davis broke into the home of a woman by the name of Selena Varich, who had been the lover of Edwards' sister, at which point Davis proceeds to pistol whip the woman before they force her to remove $6,000 cash from the bank. Valerich later stated that they informed her, quote, "You're going to listen to us now, because if you don't, we're going to kill your daughter, your father, and yourself, all three of you." After which, Davis and Edwards flee the area. The couple eventually ends up in Washington State, where Edwards discovers a bank and decides to case it, and the two of them come up with the idea of robbing the bank. They go to the bank and discover that it has no cameras, and later return, robbing it of $4,000. A brief police chase ensues, during which it begins to snow, and Davis and Edwards are able to escape, as the vehicle they are driving is already equipped with snow tires, while law enforcement's vehicles do not have any, and they basically get away scot-free. Until March 21st of 1985, when the couple is driving through Modesto, California, in a pickup truck with a busted taillight. They are pulled over by an officer who does a background check on both of them and quickly realizes that he is two fugitives from justice and places both of them under arrest. Davis ends up getting 16 years in prison, which he serves at the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo, while his girlfriend ends up doing 6 months. Edwards is going to flitter through Davis's life over the next few years. After serving her six-month jail sentence, Edwards marries a man by the name of Mike Morava. And not long after this, he is found dead with his throat slashed, along with 23 other stab wounds. And eventually, police are going to determine that Edwards' boyfriend, a man by the name of Floyd Bailey, was responsible for this crime. Edwards ends up receiving a fairly substantial financial windfall from her husband's murder in the tune of $300,000, which obviously she's going to blow through fairly quickly. It's known that she bought a Corvette during this period of time and would visit Davis in prison fairly regularly, and that the two of them eventually became engaged, although Edwards eventually calls this engagement off, which is said to have had a devastating effect on Davis's mental and emotional well-being. As for Edwards, all of this is going on, and police are still investigating the murder of her husband, and they learned that she had never become officially divorced from her first husband, which means that her marriage was therefore null and void. Officers are preparing to press charges against Davis for bigamy, which, in my opinion, is a bullshit charge, when they are contacted by Richard Allen Davis, who agrees to testify against his former lover. And because of this, Edwards ends up getting a 6-year sentence. And we are going to leave the case at this point this week with Edwards now in jail and Richard Allen Davis still in prison for the crime spree that he had gone on with Sue Edwards. The next part isn't going to be a full-on hour-long episode, so I'm probably going to release it in the next few days. That being said, I hope you have enjoyed this first look at the kidnapping and murder of Polly Kloss. Until next time, my Deathcasters and Deathcasterettes, stay morbid!